This podcast contains adult themes and language, and some of the things that we discuss may be disturbing to some listeners. In this podcast, we discuss sexual assault, torture, race, and murder. Listener discretion is advised.
Welcome, everybody, to Fruit Loop Season 3, Episode 19. Can you believe it? We've made it this far.
I know.
Thank you so much for listening. We're we have 160,000 downloads.
Wow.
Almost 170,000. And thank you again for listening to us.
Thank
for flexing with us. Fruit Loops is a podcast about true crimes committed by people of color and their victims that we do not hear or know much about. Contrary to popular belief, not all serial killers are straight, cisgender, white dudes. What? There are many well-documented cases of serial killers of color, and Fruit Loops is a podcast all about them. We will take deep dives into the fascinating lives and crimes of serial killers and true crimes committed by people of color and their victims that the media and entertainment commonly leave out because, well, the news is racist. Allegedly.
And we are Wendy and Beth. She's Wendy. I'm Beth. We're not journalists, investigators, or psychologists. Just a couple of gals interested in true crime. Also, the opinions expressed in this podcast are just that, our opinions. Please send any questions or comments to fruitloopspod@gmail.com or leave us a voicemail at 602-935-6294. And we may feature it on a future episode. Mm-hmm. Also, our website is fruitloopspod.com, and we use Fruit Loops Pod for all of our social media. Join the discussion by using the hashtag Fruit Loops Pod Discussion or by joining our Facebook group. All of the footnotes for each episode can be found on our website.
Correcto. And if you want to support the show, you can send us a donation on the Cash App. Just Google Fruit Loops Pod Cash App, or you can become a monthly patron through our Podbean patron page. We also have some merch for sale on our website. Mother, are you listening? Buy a mug. But if you can't help monetarily, no problem. You can always give us a 5-star review on Apple Podcasts or anywhere else you get your podcasts from. And this is very important. Please share our show with your friends.
Yeah.
So who are we talking about today, Beth?
Today we're talking about Adolfo de Jesus Constanzo, a Cuban-American serial killer, drug dealer, and cult leader of an infamous gang dubbed by the media as the Narco-Satanists.
Oh, boy. Well, before we dive into it, how you doing?
I'm okay. Getting ready to visit my daughter and grandson for Thanksgiving, and I'm pretty excited about that.
Awesome.
It's going to be super cold, though, because they live in North Dakota.
can they
snow
come here?
Already.
Oh, no.
Yep.
So you have to wear, like, I don't know.
Yeah, like a parka
and, and a beanie,
a hat,
and
scarves, all that stuff. Yep.
I love my mother very much. She lives up in Spokane, Washington. It's too cold, so I just never visit her.
Well, it's cheaper for me to go up there than it is for all of them to come down here. So,
right, one ticket. You just have to buy one ticket. Yeah. Makes sense. Me, I'm good. My daughter is going to be turning 5 years old, and we are planning her birthday, and we're going to just have it at a park and get a brinca. And yeah, just we invited a bunch of people, and we didn't expect people to be like, yeah, we'll come. So we're like, shit, we got to get like tables and stuff and chairs.
Now we have
to
actually have a party.
Now we actually have to do something. But it'll be fun. So anywho, now we are going to dive into some listener letters. Hello, angels.
Hello. Thank you.
What do you got there?
Well, we got a new patron, and her name is Jessie. So hip-hop air horns to you.
Yeah. We love our patrons. Thank you, Jessie, for joining us.
Yes, thank you so much. And Metamorphilia on Apple Podcasts wrote a review. The title is Absolutely Fabulous. And they said, it's my absolute favorite podcast by far. Almost awesome. Better is the Facebook group of fans. Join it. You won't regret it. And thank you so much. And we love our Facebook pod squad. They're so much fun.
They are so much fun. And if it weren't, that's for you, Beth, because you manage that Facebook group. Like, I don't know. It's like a superpower. You're like a super duper group moderator. Getting so big.
It is.
It's growing so much. So, Beth and I have talked about in the future, we might need to have somebody help
moderators.
Us moderate it. Yeah.
Because, I can't be in there all the time. I got to work and stuff. So I miss things sometimes too. So I don't want to miss anything.
Right. Yeah. I don't either. And I manage the Instagram and our Twitter feed, and then we kind of both manage like emails that come in and stuff. But we don't podcast full time. It's a side hustle for us. So sometimes we miss stuff. So if you are out there in our pod squad, we just are really, really grateful for you being there.
Yeah, for sure.
Terrence DC on Apple Podcasts says, one of my favorites. I thought I knew true crime. I thought no one could name a serial killer I'd never heard of. Then I came across Fruit Loops, and Wendy and Beth taught me a thing or two. Funny, informative, and on point. This quickly became a favorite podcast for me, and I especially love Culture Corner. Keep up the great work, and thank you!
Yeah, thank you, Terrence.
Yes. Yeah. So now we're going to take a quick break, and then we're going to dive into the story when we come back.
Hey, Wendy and Beth. This is Stacy giving you guys a call from Modesto, California. Yes, where Scott Peterson murdered his pregnant wife. I just want to call and let you guys know that I am a true crime podcast avid listener, and I just found you guys today, and so far I have listened to 2 episodes, and I think you guys are so entertaining. I love the podcast. Keep it up. I love the name Fruit Loops. That's so awesome. I will be continuing to listen to you guys, and I love the podcast so far. Hope you guys have a good one.
So now we are back, and can you refresh our memory, Beth? Who are we talking about again?
We're talking about Adolfo de Jesus Constanzo, a serial killer and cult leader in Mexico. His nickname was El Padrino.
Padrino is Spanish for godfather.
Yeah.
So now we're going to get into the stats, which is my favorite part of true crime. So Adolfo de Jesus Constanzo, a.k.a. the godfather of Matamoros. Matamoros is a town, a border town in Texas, a.k.a. the witch doctor, was a serial killer and cult leader who performed ritual torture and human sacrifices. And boy, oh boy, I mean, cutting off limbs, cutting off genitals, taking out Adam's apples. He had at least 15 victims, but I've heard different accounts because there was a bunch of bodies buried up from this compound that he had. And I heard a number as high as 23. So,
yeah, there were probably more. Yeah.
Yeah. His crimes took place from 1986 to 1989. And if you look at this dude's hairstyle, it's got mid 1980s all over it.
Yeah.
His victims were men. By the way, he was a member of the LGBTQ community. He was openly bisexual. And some of his followers were also LGBTQ community members. But in the 80s, we didn't have the verbiage to describe these kinds of individuals. The crimes took place in, again, Matamoros, Mexico. It is a border town, and college students can go there for spring break.
Yeah.
You know, you can drink there at 16 legally, and you don't have to be 21. So anyway, it's very, very close to the Texas border. Constanza went down in a blaze of glory on May 6, 1989, and he did not die at the hands of the police. Actually, he had one of his followers kill him. So now we're going to dive into the setting. Take us there, Beth.
Constanzo had roots in Cuba, where Palo, a religion with various denominations, was developed among African enslaved people and their descendants who originated from the Congo region. Syncretism, or the blending of religious ideas, is common in areas with a past of colonialism and slavery.
Mm-hmm.
The enslaved and conquered people have their own religions, which they would then adapt to Christianity when they were forced to convert.
Right. They were forced to convert. And I've said this before on the podcast, the people who were transported against their will from Africa also brought their religions with
yep.
them. So they adapted. But Palo in Spanish literally means stick. And Palo, they use the stick in their religious
ceremonies
yeah. and stuff. Yeah. So in Afro-Cuban religions, one of the characteristics is the union of African gods with Catholic saints. Other examples of this are found in Haitian voodoo, Jamaican Rastafarianism, Afro-Brazilian Candomblé, and Afro-Cuban Santería. I don't practice Santería. I ain't got no crystal ball. Okay, sorry.
The people would continue to worship their own spirits or deities by connecting them to Catholic saints, using the saints to hide the continuation of their religious practices, or in some instances, Catholic saints were actually integrated into their religious traditions.
Denominations of Palo, oftentimes referred to as branches, include Mayombe, Monte, Briyumba, and Kimbisa. The Palo organizational structure follows the model of a family. During slavery, when blood families often were broken up by slaveholders, this model was particularly significant and taken literally.
The Palo religion is based on nature and our natural surroundings, such as plants, herbs, sticks, soil, rocks, and various types of water, including water from rain, the sea, a river, a lake, and ponds, streams, and creeks. It also includes the moon, the sun, and different seasons.
In Palo, all that exists is considered animated by spirits. Natural objects, particularly sticks or palos, as I said earlier, are thought to be infused with powers. These objects are used in rites and religious practice. Problems can be overcome through rituals that make use of powers that are available in the natural world and in the various spirits that they worship.
A Nganga is a creation in Palo that is made from an iron cauldron into which several items such as bones and sticks are placed. It's made by a Palero, which is a Palo priest, and is considered to be alive, that there's a spirit captured inside of it. It's used for magic and divination and sometimes to venerate the Mpongo, spirits of a higher power or gods. The Ngongo is to a Palero what an altar is to a Catholic priest.
In Palo, there is no good or bad magic. For example, a woman might come to a Palero with the problem of an abusive boyfriend. The Palero performs rituals to help her with this problem, and at some points afterwards, the boyfriend is killed in a car accident. The Palero only asked for a solution to the problem, not for the boyfriend to be killed, but his death was the result. However, there is no judgment on good or evil because it is considered the will of the gods.
Historically, there's not been religious literature available for most Afro-Caribbean religious traditions because the information was passed down orally. Traditionally, only Paleros, other initiates, and active devotees take part in rituals and worship.
Also, because of their histories and persecution during the colonial period is still here today anyway, and afterward, and because contemporary society and media continue to demonize them, there is a high level of secrecy around Afro-Caribbean beliefs and practices. And this secrecy is part of what scares non-devotees, aka white people.
The particular denomination of Palo that Constanzo purported to practice was Palo Mayombe, which has a really bad rap. Mm-hmm. Lots of people describe Palo Mayombe as the dark side of Santeria, but it actually has nothing to do with Santeria. It is derived from a totally different group of Africans, totally different tribe members.
Interesting.
There are some commonalities, but it's a completely different religion. It would be like saying Christianity and Judaism are the same religion.
Oh, I'm glad that you said that because the sources that I referenced,
they all
they all say that it's the same.
Or like a darker version of it. Yeah.
Yeah. And I mean, not all santeros, not all santerias are bad. It's just a practice that they engage in, and it's not all evil. So I just want to throw that out there.
Yeah.
So in Palo Mayombe, there is no human sacrifice. Human bones may be used in the Ngaga to attract ancestral spirits, but they are not from people who were sacrificed, but from those already dead, from anatomical specimens or sometimes grave robbing. And Adolfo engages in some of that activity.
Yeah.
And aside from the ritual sticks, other objects also go into the Ngaga. According to one palero, if you want the spirit to keep you safe from a gun or a machete, those things go into the Ngaga. I also heard sources say that the palero will cut himself and put blood into the Ngaga.
Yeah, they put blood and soil and all kinds of stuff goes in there. And if you see pictures of them, they look freaky. You know, because there's all this stuff in there. But when I read that they put like a gun or a machete in there to keep them safe from those things, I found that really interesting.
Right. Or I can't remember where I saw this, but they'll put like if they want fertility, they'll put people's genitals in.
Oh, my
in there. So, you know. Anyway, now we're going to dive into the killer's early life. So hit it, Beth.
Adolfo Constanzo was born on November 1st, 1962 in Miami, Florida. His mother, Delia Aurora Gonzalez de Valle, was a widowed Cuban immigrant. She gave birth to him when she was only 15 years old, and she would eventually have three children in total. Delia moved to San Juan, Puerto Rico, when her first husband died, and then she remarried. While in San Juan, Constanzo was baptized Roman Catholic, and he actually served as an altar boy, but he was also influenced by his mother's participation in Palo Mayombe.
So a little culture corner, I don't know how many people know this, but Cuban immigrants, as soon as they touch American soil, are granted residency,
safe
residency. So all they have to do is touch the Miami beach and they are cleared to go. And Miami is a very Cuban city.
Yeah.
And Cubans, I don't want to say the Cubans are racist, but white Cubans don't consider themselves like brown people. They also tend to not look favorably on the black Cubans, the African Cubans that are from the same country as they are. And so, yeah. And so I have a Cuban American friend and she says Cubans are racist. So obviously this is a bigger discussion that we can have at another time, but I know that Adolfo de Jesus Constanzo is a Cuban American, but I do think that Cuban racism is kind of an interesting
dynamic, for sure.
So Adolfo's family returned to Miami in 1972, but his stepfather died soon after, and his mother was soon remarried, and his new stepfather was involved in the local drug trade and the occult. The local lore is that Constanzo's mother and grandmother were both known priestesses who worshipped the spirits at altars in their Miami, Florida homes. Neighbors of the Constanzos remember that they would sometimes find dead animals on their doorstep in their little Havana neighborhood.
Good morning. Here's a dead chicken.
Good morning. Here's a dead chicken. But I thought she would do it if somebody like pissed her off.
Yeah, if she was mad
at them. Somebody did her wrong, right. She would just put a dead chicken. And I don't know, about you. Again, I'm half Central American, and I also live in South Phoenix. There are chickens everywhere.
Yeah,
and
yeah.
Chickens, horses, people riding up the street in horses, chickens at the elementary school. Like it would be easy to get a chicken and like put it on your neighbor's house.
Yeah, yeah.
Anyway.
Delia was a habitual criminal, arrested 30 times on various charges ranging from trespassing to shoplifting, check fraud, grand theft, and child neglect. But the charges never seemed to stick, and she always escaped with probation. She credited her good luck to her religion. Evidence suggests that Adolfo's mother also included him in her crimes, as both Adolfo and his mother were arrested several times. And I'm assuming they were arrested together, but I'm not sure. But that was part of something that I read.
Okay. Well, Delia allegedly had Adolfo blessed by a Haitian Palo Mayombe Palero after the Palero declared that Adolfo was a chosen one and quote unquote destined for great power. She believed this and groomed him for his future. And at an early age, he was taught to torture and kill animals for ritual sacrifice and was praised for showing no remorse. By the way, have you ever seen anybody kill a chicken?
No.
Oh, guess it's just me, huh?
Well, it's, you know, common on farms and stuff. I know my mom's family, they killed chickens, and my aunt, they had a pet chicken.
Oh,
my aunt and uncle and their kids, their two kids, they had a pet chicken. And one day the kids came home and there was chicken for dinner and it was the pet chicken.
Oh, me. Oh, my.
Isn't that crazy?
Me. Oh my.
I still think about that. Like, what?
Well, I just wanted, so like my African American family, I've seen them kill chicken by grabbing its head and then twisting it around like a lasso.
Mm-hmm.
And then my Central American family, I've seen them chop off the heads with a machete. So
yeah,
I've seen a lot of
I know my mom's, her mom would kill chickens out in the yard for dinner, you know. She would chop their heads off with an axe.
Yeah. Oh, yeah, an axe. Yeah. Yeah. Well, did you watch it, though?
Oh, it was my mom's mom when my mom was little, so I wasn't born yet.
Oh, okay. Okay. So you weren't, okay. So
yeah,
you were not in the picture yet.
No, I'd have been traumatized, I think.
It is traumatizing because I have cousins who went to Central America, and whenever we would go, we would go for like 2 or 3 weeks at a time. And I have one cousin who has just been like completely traumatized by seeing people cut chickens' heads off.
I loved animals when I was a kid. So, I mean, I just loved animals. I wanted to be a veterinarian. But then I realized later that I had to, you know, take care of sick animals and watch animals die, and decided that wasn't it. That wasn't what I wanted to be.
Yeah, I love animals, but I also love blood and guts.
Oh, that's true.
Anyway,
yeah.
What's next?
Adolfo barely graduated from high school at the bottom of his class, and he dropped out of junior college after his first semester. His interests lay elsewhere, and learning the secrets of Palo Mayombe from his Haitian Palero mentor was at the top of the list.
Mm.
He also spent time cruising the gay bars in Miami, and I first read that Palo Mayombe takes no position on sexuality, but further reading suggests that Palo Mayombe actually prohibits homosexuality. But I don't know what Adolfo's Palero's position was on this, or if Adolfo would have cared either way. He seemed like he was pretty confident and didn't really give a shit what other people thought.
Yeah, this was happened in the 80s.
Yeah.
I think that if Adolfo had the opportunity to, I guess, pick a side, he might have identified as pansexual or bisexual. I got the sense that he was just somebody who loved
free
everybody.
Love, yeah.
So, Adolfo's Haitian Palero, who was involved in helping people in the drug trade, justified his involvement by allegedly telling Adolfo, "Let the non-believers kill themselves with drugs. We will profit from their foolishness."
Adolfo claimed that he was psychic and could predict the future, and his mother believed that he had predicted the attempted assassination of Ronald Reagan in 1981. And at 21, he was initiated into Palo Mayombe and became a Palero. He allegedly pledged himself to Kadiampambe, which is Palo's version of Satan, devoting himself to evil for profit.
Okay, so that's his early life. Now we're going to get into the timeline. So here I go. Constanzo was handsome and he started modeling. A modeling assignment took him to Mexico City in 1983, and he spent his free time telling fortunes with tarot cards in Mexico City's red light district. Seeing more opportunity for his practice in Mexico City, Adolfo moved there in 1984, setting himself up as a Palo Mayombe Palero and began predicting futures for money. And you might get into this, but he would like read the fortunes of like politicians, celebrities,
all kinds of people. Constanzo was also very charismatic and quickly gained a following. He recruited his first disciples, including two men, Martin Quintana Rodriguez and Omar Orea Ochoa, who became his lovers. They both moved in with him, and although Martin and Omar were not exactly happy with the situation, they put up with it. Constanzo was emotionally abusive to them and played them off of each other, making them vie for his affections.
He continued collecting other followers as his reputation spread. He read futures, offering wealthy drug dealers predictions of safe times to transport drugs and freeing them from curses. He offered magic to make them bulletproof and invisible to police. But in secret, Constanzo had connections in the police department who he would pay for information.
As well as drug cartels, his clients included doctors, police officers, narcotics investigators, even someone from Interpol.
Wait, is that the British FBI?
That's the international police. So,
oh, that makes sense.
Yeah.
Interpol. Okay.
Yeah.
Got it.
When the drug lord he was working with experienced increased profits, Constanzo was credited and they treated him with reverence, believing that he was a godlike protector.
Small g on the god.
Yes.
Now, he called himself El Padrino, the godfather, and was earning huge sums of money. So he was living large. Mm-hmm. Realizing that taking so much money from drug dealers could be dangerous, he put on a show raiding graveyards for human bones to feed his ngaga, along with blood, animal remains, spiders, and scorpions.
I know.
They're terrible visitors.
According to Constanzo's ledgers, one dealer in Mexico City paid him $40,000 for magical services over 3 years' time. In 1986, Constanzo was introduced to the Calzada family, then one of Mexico's dominant drug cartels. Constanzo won them over and profited immensely from them.
Constanzo came to believe that his magical powers alone were responsible for the Calzada's family continued success and survival. And in April 1987, demanded a full partnership in the syndicate, but was rejected.
And then on April 30th, 1987, Guillermo Calzada Sanchez and six members of his household vanished under mysterious circumstances. They were reported missing on May 1st, and police noted melted candles and other evidence of a strange religious ceremony at Calzada's office.
Well, 6 days later, officers began finding mutilated remains in the Zumpango River. Seven corpses were eventually recovered, all bearing signs of sadistic torture. Fingers, toes, ears removed, hearts and genitals excised. That means cut off. Part of the spine ripped from one body, two other corpses missing their brains.
Yeah, and he was never, they never said that he did this, Constanzo, but it seems likely that he did.
Yeah, and some of the sources I got information from seem to indicate that he was totally into it, like that he did most of the torturing. So I obviously don't know for sure, but
yeah.
I was under the impression that he was super down to do really bad stuff.
Yeah, I think he was. In the spring of 1987, Constanza moved to Matamoros, right across the border from Brownsville, Texas. He probably just wanted to get the fuck out of Mexico City after the Cazada murders.
Sure, okay.
There he met Sara Aldrete. Sara grew up poor in Matamoros, but attended high school in Brownsville while still living in Matamoros, which I didn't know you could do.
Yeah, so Matamoros is one of those towns like El Paso. So right. People might live in Mexico, but send their kids to school in the United States so they can get a really, really good education. Right. People might work in a border town across the border, and they're just not back all and forth. Rapists and murderers.
No, yeah. No, most okay. of them are good people.
Most, yeah. Oh Lord have mercy, I don't know what's happening with this country anyway. Sara gained resident alien status so that she could attend Texas Southmost College. She was an exceptional grade A student and was described by her fellow students and teachers as very pretty, very warm, and sociable. Fun fact, she's 6 feet tall and 6 foot one.
Yeah, she's very tall.
Oh my God, my neck hurts already.
In 1987, she met Constanzo in Matamoros. He seduced her, telling her that they had a future together and that they belonged together. Mm. She thought he was arrogant, but handsome and worldly, and she was flattered and intrigued.
Mm. Well, I don't know. Again, I mean, he is super 1980s, but he is very handsome.
He is very handsome. He kind of, he doesn't look exactly like Emilio Estevez or
oh hello
young, you know when he was
Ducks.
Young and yeah. Charlie Sheen who else those guys back then that were really popular. There's another guy too. He doesn't look exactly like them. He kind of looks like an
who's Charlie Sheen's dad?
Martin Sheen.
Yeah. I think he's Cuban.
Is he? Oh yeah, he could be. Yeah,
I think so. I don't know. Don't fact check me.
But if you look at him, you'll see like he has the same kind of hair, but also his facial structure is similar to them. And I want to say one of the Coreys, not Corey Haim, the other one, Corey.
The dead one? Okay. Well,
anyway, those guys.
This podcast took a very sad turn.
Yeah, we're talking about torture and murder, but one of the Coreys dies and we're devastated.
Oh, no. Santa Maria.
Not one of the Coreys.
No. Corey.
Anyway.
That might sound very intense. Anyway, so he said he was a psychic and he told her things about herself and she didn't think he could possibly know those things. He told her that she had been chosen by the gods, small g, that there is something dark and beautiful in her and that together they could be rich and powerful. And this was your mistake, sis.
He was love bombing her.
Yeah. A love bombing. Yes. Oh, boom, boom, I love
boom,
that.
Love bombing. When he introduced her to his religion, she was afraid but also entranced. She wanted to please Constanzo and liked the power that she felt with Paulo. She was initiated into his religion and named by Constanzo as La Madrina, which means godmother, to Constanzo's El Padrino.
So Sara was still going to school in Brownsville, crossing the border regularly. She seemed like a normal college student to her peers. And then when she crossed the border into Matamoros, she became La Madrina. She was living a double life. And by the way, when I was in, I went to college in California, in Southern California. And you, I mean, it was very easy to cross the border and go party. And me and my husband used to go to Mexico all the time to just like, yeah, just like hang out and party. And it was fun. It was fun.
Yeah, I bet.
Anyway.
The most important thing to Constanzo was that his initiates obey him. He let Sara know that if she didn't obey him, that she was of no use to him and would be discarded. Mm. Constanza started finding more converts. And as La Madrina, Constanzo expected Sara to provide sex to the converts. Love and fear drove Sara to comply. What were you going to say? Are you just gasping?
Oh, I just think that sounds awful.
Yeah.
Yeah.
This reminds me actually a lot of Charles Manson. He also seduced female converts and then convinced them to have sex with other men in order to attract more male converts. And
I did not know that.
And his method of seducing them was also similar to Constanza's. And a lot of the women felt like Manson could see inside of their soul, like he really knew them. And like Constanzo, he was just really good at manipulating people.
Yeah. And it sounds like he learned that from a very, very young age. Sarah introduced Constanzo to Elio Hernandez, someone she knew in Matamoros, who ran a family drug cartel. Constanzo convinced Hernandez that he could help him with his business for half of the cartel's profits. The Hernandez cartel was not doing well at the time, and they agreed.
Constanzo then moved his operations to Rancho Santa Elena, a remote ranch about 20 miles from Matamoros near the Texas border. I believe that this ranch was owned by the Hernandez cartel, and Constanzo didn't actually live there, but he did make a shed on the property into a temple, and he created a Nganga there.
So this Nganga thing, we explained what it is, right?
Yeah.
Okay. So the cartel starting making more money, convincing the Constanzo's rituals were working, and they became complete believers in Constanzo. At the time, animals were being used as sacrifices in the rituals, chickens and goats. Then Constanzo said that the spirits were demanding more than small animal sacrifices, and followers were ordered to bring human sacrifices for the rituals.
On May 28, 1988, Constanzo shot drug dealer Hector de la Fuente and a farmer named Moises Castillo, but the sacrifices didn't satisfy him. Mutilation and pain were essential to Constanza, and he said the spirits were more likely to smile on a sacrifice that died in agony. They must die screaming, El Padrino told his flock. Constanzo is said to have enjoyed the screaming. So, yeah, there you go.
That is super duper fucked up. And I heard some podcasts really got into the weeds in terms of the human torture.
Yeah, I don't want to do that.
And the limbs. Are you sure? And the limbs cut off. And are you sure?
No, we'll touch on it. But yeah, I don't want to get into the weeds. That's not my thing.
So on August 10th, 1988, in reprisal for an $800,000 drug ripoff, rival narcotics dealers kidnapped Ovidio Hernandez and his two-year-old son. Constanzo's converts kidnapped a stranger 2 days later and tortured him to death at Rancho Santa Elena, chanting prayers for the safe release of Hernandez and his son. When the hostages were released on August 13th without a ransom changing hands, Constanzo claimed full credit for it.
Yeah, and we don't know why they were released, but that's what happened. It was the magic,
that's
apparently.
What happened. There you go. Yeah. Magia Santeria.
In November 1988, after 35-year-old cult member Jorge Valente de Fierro Gomez violated El Padrino's ban on using drugs, Constanzo made him the group's next sacrifice. Then on Valentine's Day, happy Valentine's Day, 1989, competing smuggler Ezequiel Rodriguez Luna was tortured to death at the ranch. Two other dealers, Ruben Vela Garza and Ernesto Rivas Diaz, were also killed when they wandered into the ceremony uninvited.
So he had this weird, like, no drug rule, but I also have my interpretation from some of the sources that I've consumed indicate that these ceremonies were alcohol filled.
Oh, really? I didn't read that anywhere.
Yeah. So why? Why no drugs?
I don't know.
I mean, if you're going to allow alcohol, why no
drugs? I didn't read anything about the alcohol anywhere, so I don't know.
So again, Beth likes to read. Wendy likes to listen and watch. So I listened and watched something that said that these were alcohol fueled ceremonies. Okay. Do I know if it's credible? I don't know. I do not know. Don't fact check me, okay? Anyway, 9 days later, the cult kidnapped another stranger, never identified, but he put up such a fight that Constanzo ordered Elio Hernandez to shoot him without customary rituals. On February 25th, the group accidentally kidnapped Jose Garcia, the 14-year-old cousin of, I think, one of the cult members. Yes, slaying him before they recognized the error.
Sara was never let inside during the rituals, as Constanzo thought that having a woman there would bring bad vibes. But she knew that people were being killed. Money was pouring in from the drug cartel, convincing the converts that the sacrifices worked. Constanza bought Sara new clothes, jewelry, and a new car. She was also convinced of his powers.
You know, if I had a man in my life who was doing terrible things, but also bought me really pretty things and made me feel secure financially, I would just shut the fuck up. And
not me. No, thank you.
That's just me, because I have no morals. At least 15 people were sacrificed, possibly more. They targeted mostly the poor and drug rivals. And according to Constanza, I feel like it's like George.
I know.
Could stand
but I keep thinking too.
Yeah. The Ngaga had to be fed, and its strength grew with each sacrifice. Most of the people were cut and mutilated before death, and some say that Constanzo also raped them. Yeah, I heard many of the victims were sodomized, yeah. And I don't know if it was with other people's genitalia or with broomsticks or whatever, but
yeah,
that's what they said.
Constanza then began targeting people for different reasons, and Sara was often used as bait. He wanted a strong man to give the Nganga strength, so Sara found a muscular man who was then kidnapped and killed, and his muscles were cut off of him and fed to the Nganga.
Right.
Sara also invited a man over to her house, and one of the Hernandez family kidnapped him, brought him to the ranch, and then he was killed, and they took out his heart and fed it to the Nganga.
Mm. Eventually, Constanza decided that the Nganga needed a different kind of sacrifice, a more powerful sacrifice. Constanza told his converts that he wanted an educated American college student to feed the Nganga. It was spring break. Spring break, girls gone wild! And American college students were everywhere, and he wanted a brain to feed on the Nganga to help the spirits think better.
Sara attempted to get a college classmate to come to a party with her, but the classmate declined, as he did not really drink or party, and he did not enjoy participating in the spring break activities. It was only later that he realized that he could have been a victim.
So now we're going to get into the investigation, and things really cook up when a white American kid goes missing. So on March 14th, 1989, college student Mark Kilroy, guess his race, disappeared in Matamoros while on spring break. He was with three friends, and they had been drinking all night. While walking to the U.S. border, his friends lost track of Mark, and they thought that he must have joined another group of people, because I think he was talking to a girl who had won, man, the spring break activities. He was talking to a girl who won like a wet t-shirt contest or a tan,
yeah, something like that.
Show
yeah.
us your tan line contest. And they waited for him at the car, but he never showed up.
The friends then went back to the hotel to sleep, assuming that Mark would eventually come back. But when they awoke and realized that Mark had never come back to the hotel either, they called Mark's parents, who told them to contact the police.
Tangent. But when I was in college, my white girlfriends were all like, yeah, spring break, we're gonna go to Cabo, and they all like bought plane tickets and
oh
like
my God.
Stayed in one of the parents' timeshares, and they did this every year. Wow. And I would ask my parents, can I go? And they were like, are you fucking kidding
no.
me? You're gonna go party with those crazy ass white girls? Wouldn't know. Come home and get your dental work done. That's yeah. what I did for spring break every year.
I never went to a spring break either.
No, I never went to one of those. I mean, we would go on weekends every now and then to, like, you know.
Yeah. Bars and stuff.
Right. But never like a whole like hotel
trip to Florida or wherever. Yeah. No, never did that.
Absolutely not. And if my children asked me to do some shit like that, no fucking
Seems
way.
Crazy to me. Yeah.
Insane. Do you want to get arrested? Do you want to die? Do you want to get AIDS? Do you want
to get hepatitis? And torture to death?
No. Where are we? Oh, okay. Initially, police were not too concerned. Apparently, spring breakers disappear, quote unquote, in Mexico all the time. No big deal. Only to show up later with a terrible hangover. No big deal. But Mark's parents called a relative who was a custom agent, and he pushed police to investigate. And because Mark was a young, white, attractive American male, his disappearance launched a massive police search. Because all lives matter.
Yeah. And yet Constanzo did not stop his ritual sacrifices. On March 28th, 1989, Sara Aldrete's ex-boyfriend, Gilberto Sosa, was tortured and killed, then sacrificed to the Yanganga.
On April 1st, 1989, at a routine checkpoint in Mexico, a man blew through in his pickup truck, not bothering to stop. Police decided that rather than just pulling him over, they would follow him to see where he went. They followed him to a ranch. There, police questioned him, and they recognized him as 20-year-old Serafin Hernandez Garcia, part of the Hernandez drug cartel.
Police also found bales of marijuana and a handgun. So they arrested Serafin and a few other guys, plus another man who told them that he was the caretaker at the ranch. At the police station, the caretaker saw pictures of Mark Kilroy and told the police that he knew him. He said that he'd seen him tied up at the ranch and that he'd fed him and gave him water, but then that he'd never seen him again.
Serafin Hernandez was interrogated, but he thought he was invincible because of Constanzo's magic. So he started talking. He apparently didn't think it mattered what he said because he thought that the magic would protect him.
Yeah, and that's why he blew through the checkpoint, too, because he thought he was invisible.
Oh, my fucking God.
Yeah, he wasn't a big thinker, that guy.
What a genius.
The police then raided the ranch, but found it deserted. In the shack, which Constanzo had used as a temple, police found an iron cauldron with sticks poking out, the Yanganga. It smelled terrible. I can only imagine. Yep. Looking closer, they could see bones, a dead chicken, and then a human brain. And the federales did not want to go into the shack or mess with it at all because it had something to do with brujeria, which means witchcraft.
By the way, we talked about Constanzo's early childhood, but I also heard one source say that his mom kept his house very filthy, like it was disgusting.
Yeah.
And so maybe all these like dirty, yucky smells was like, no big deal.
No big deal. Yeah.
This is usual. Police brought Serafina Hernandez to the ranch, who took officers to an area behind the shack and indicated that Mark Kilroy could be found there. Police made Serafin dig up the grave where they found the body of Mark Kilroy, and his brain was missing.
Serafin said that he didn't know why they were making such a big deal out of this one, that there were more people buried around there, and he told them where, and the whole area was dug up. A total of 15 bodies were found, including the 14-year-old boy that was the cousin of one of the Hernandez cartel. Mm-hmm. Most were locals or rival drug associates. Some had been shot at close range and others hacked to death with a machete.
Well, you know, I used to play with a machete in my grandparents' backyard and I didn't realize how deadly they could be. Serafin was questioned by U.S. Customs, the Sheriff's Department, and the DEA. He told them that he didn't kill anyone and had just buried the bodies. He said their blood went into the Ngaga to give them protection and good luck. He called Constanzo Padrino. He said during the rituals, Constanzo would go into a trance, was possessed by the spirit in the Ngaga, and the spirit demanded these sacrifices.
Constanzo and Sara had gone on the run with Constanzo's male lovers, Martin and Omar, and a Hernandez family hitman named Alvaro de Leon Valdez, but called El Dubi, and that's what we'll call him too, because that's too long.
Yeah, fair enough.
They hid out in an apartment in Mexico City. The FBI joined the hunt for the cult members, and an international manhunt was initiated.
By the way, I have to say, at this point in time in the late 80s and early 90s, I think Mexico City was the murder capital of the world.
Yeah, it was a pretty dangerous, place to go. Right? Yeah. Mm-hmm.
So while in hiding, Constanzo read betrayal in his tarot cards. He was paranoid, kept an Uzi. Ooh, Uzi, that's a big ass gun by his side, and rarely slept for more than a few minutes at a time. He threatened his people, telling them, "They cannot kill you, but I can." Boom.
Paulo Mayombe specialists were flown in from Miami.
In the city where the heat is on at night as it is to the break of dawn. Welcome to Miami. Bienvenido a Miami. What were you saying?
And they told police that the way to find Constanzo was to kill his nganga. A photo of Constanzo was placed in the nganga, then gasoline was poured over the nganga and the shed, and everything was set on fire, all while a Mexican TV station filmed it. When Constanzo watched this on TV, he went wild with rage and stormed about the small apartment, smashing lamps and overturning furniture. He believed that his power was gone.
Uh-oh. Well, there are two versions of what happened next. The first is that Sara... and by the way, welcome to Culture Corner. So in the Spanish language, the H is silent. So when you see a woman whose name is like Sara or Cristina that doesn't have an H in it.
No H
means Latina. Anyway, The first is that Sara was walking back from a store when she was spotted by someone who notified police. The second is that they were searching for a missing child and pulled up outside of the apartment to search. Constanza saw police and, paranoid, he started shooting at them. Oh, me, oh, my.
But in any case, on May 6, 1989, the group was discovered and about 180 armed police surrounded the apartment building. Constanzo started shooting at the police with his Uzi. According to El Dubi, Constanzo then gave his Uzi to him. Quote, "He told me to kill him and Martin. I told him I couldn't do it, but he hit me in the face and threatened that everything would go bad for me in hell. Then he hugged Martin and I just stood in front of them and shot them."
Wow. Constanzo and Martin Quintana were dead when police stormed the apartment, slumped together in a closet. El Dubi, Omar Orrea, and Sara Aldrete were arrested. El Dubi cheerfully told police, "The Godfather will not be dead for long." So now we're going to head into the trial.
Which is pretty short.
Hit it, Beth.
14 cult members were indicted on various charges, including multiple murder, weapons and narcotics violations, conspiracy and obstruction of justice. El Dubi confessed to killing Adolfo Constanzo and Martin Quintana. And in August of 1990, El Dubi was convicted on that crime and given a 35-year prison term. Omar Orrea was also convicted of murder, but he died of AIDS before he could be sentenced.
That's too bad. So Sara Aldrete first posed as a victim, denying her involvement in the murders. She insisted that she never practiced any religion but Christian Santeria. She claimed that the reports of the murders at Rancho Santa Elena took her completely by surprise, but she had a lot of knowledge about the crimes, and jurors just did not buy it. And in 1994, Aldrete and four male accomplices were convicted of a murder. So where are they now? Tell us.
Sara Aldrete was sentenced to 62 years in prison and is still incarcerated in Mexico. If Aldrete is ever released from prison, American authorities plan to prosecute her for the murder of Mark Kilroy. The other cult members each received 67 years. Two cult members actually still remain at large.
Goodness gracious. Mark Kilroy's parents believe that he was killed in order to shed light on what the cult was doing. Devout Catholics, they believe that it was all part of God's plan. They took comfort in knowing that he had time to pray before he was killed and that he is now with God. So now we're going to get into what we believe made the killer snap and our takeaways. So, Beth, this looks juicy. Tell me.
So I read a Reddit Ask Me Anything with a Paulo Mayombe Polero. Mm-hmm. And the Polero said, somebody asked him about Adolfo Constanzo and if he was actually practicing Paulo Mayombe.
Okay.
And the Polero said, quote, "Oh man, that Constanzo scumbag."
Hot take.
"He grew up peripherally around Paulo, but was a twisted serial killer. His madness manifested through Paulo because he was familiar with it. Had he been a Christian, he would have been crucifying people or stoning them. What he did has nothing to do with what Paulo is or how the religion is practiced. It has to do with Constanzo being a lunatic."
Uh-oh.
"Most of what he wrote was nonsense and madness. There is no human sacrifice in Paulo." And then I read another quote from a psychologist, and we'll link all these things in our footnotes.
Absolutely.
And the psychologist said, "As a child, Adolfo is likely to have experienced a sense of isolation and separation from the rest of the world. His world comprised of himself, his mother, and a religion that allowed crime and drug dealing. Not only would he have felt different to everyone else, but he was also prevented from seeing how others live, how others' mothers behave, and how children generally are not taught to steal, but to play."
Hmm.
"The impact of this is immense, from giving Adolfo a very narrow view of the world to making it very difficult for him to develop healthy interpersonal and relationship skills. This set him up for a lonely childhood and a maladjusted adulthood."
Interesting.
So he had a fucked up childhood that was steeped in crime. He was brought up to believe that he was special.
Mm-hmm.
And I think he was a narcissist who felt like he was above the law and that he could do anything that he wanted. He wasn't following Paulo Mayombe, but took it as a starting point and then made up his own religion. Because he was taught to sacrifice animals with no remorse, he was desensitized to killing. He said his Nganga demanded more sacrifices, but I think that, like a lot of other serial killers, when he started killing people, he found that he really liked it and he wanted more.
Hot take. Yeah, no, I agree with you. I don't know if he really stood a chance given his upbringing.
Yeah.
But I also did want to say that religions like Santeria, Paulo Mayombe, people seek religions to find peace, to find purpose. And I don't think that I just am not a fan of yucking somebody else's yum. So I don't think that we need to negatively talk about or
demonize
these religions, because for many they're meaningful.
Well, any religion can be turned bad.
Sure.
If somebody's bad and they want to, you know, we've
they can be bad as hell.
The Westboro Baptist Church, you know, we've got ISIS, you know. The Westboro Baptist Church, that's the one that pickets funerals, and they're very anti-gay. They say that gay people cause hurricanes and stuff.
Yeah. Oh, boy. Oh, boy. Yeah. I mean, who's to say who's right? You know what I mean?
Yeah. You can take any religion and make it bad.
You can. I think in general, though, I think most people seek religion because they want peace.
Yeah.
And
most religious people are good people. Yeah.
But yeah, I agree. As somebody who grew up in the church, I am a PK pastor's kid. And it sucked. But anyway, I just think, you know, religion is a very It just is what it is. And I think you can make it good and you can make it bad. And I don't think that just because somebody worships a different God than you or practices a little bit differently than you makes them an evil person. And right. So we should not look at people who practice Santeria or the Palo Miombe or et cetera, et cetera. They're just people like us.
Yeah. And also I wanted to mention that in one of the documentaries that I watched, they were talking about how a lot of the people who practice Palo Mayombe also go to Catholic churches. So they'll like do a ritual and then they'll go to mass. So,
Oh, interesting.
It's very interesting. Yeah.
Very much. Yeah. Wow. No. And again, don't yuck somebody else's yum. They're right. Not all bad. Okay.
Yep.
So now we're going to get into how not to get murdered. If you love true crime and you don't want to die, here's a tip for you.
Oh boy.
What do you got there?
I got lost. This segment is not intended to be victim blaming. We thought of this segment because I read somewhere that a lot of people listen to true crime because they want to know what they can do to be safer. This is not meant to blame the victims. It's just learning from other people's mistakes. Sometimes we have no suggestions for a particular episode and we'll just offer up generic tips.
Yes. So because Mark Kilroy, you know, the white guy who was killed, was out drinking the night he was kidnapped, we're going to give some tips about drinking safely. Drinking alcohol can make us more vulnerable or prone to accidents. Story of my life. I have a fractured orbital bone.
Oh my gosh.
Anyway, be careful. The more you drink, the less you'll be able to spot dangerous situations and you're more likely to do something risky. Oh my God, I would be dead if there weren't people looking out for me when I was in college. Oh my God. So eat before you drink. And while you drink, be sure to drink plenty of water. Keep an eye out on your friends. If you are going out in a group, plan to arrive together and leave together. If you decide to leave early, let your friends know. Don't just have sex with the guy in the backyard of your friend's house and not tell your friends what's happening. Have a backup. I am wild. Have a backup plan. Sometimes plans change quickly. You might realize it's not safe for you to drive home. Yeah, that guy said he would take you home, but he's probably lying. Or the group you arrived with might decide to go somewhere you don't feel comfortable. Download a few different rideshare apps on your phone and consider bringing an external cell phone charger that can be used without an electrical outlet. Yeah, like one of those charging sticks.
Yeah,
great idea. Know what you are drinking. Look, if a dude says, here is something I think you will like, if you didn't see him pour it, don't drink it. Avoid large batch drinks. Whew. I can't tell you the mistakes I've made on a trash can full of jungle juice. Drinks like punches that may have deceptively high alcohol content, but will ruin your life and your reputation. Don't leave drinks unattended. Don't accept drinks from people you don't know or trust. Check with yourself. Check in with yourself periodically to register. How do you feel? Am I a little too tipsy? Should I go home? Should I go sleep?
Should I drink some water? Yeah.
Should I drink some water? If you think that you've had too much, ask a trusted friend to help you get water or get home safely. Be aware of sudden changes in the way your body feels. Do you feel more intoxicated than you are comfortable with? Some drugs are odorless, colorless, and tasteless, and can be added to your drink without you noticing. If you feel uncomfortable, tell a friend and tell them to take you to a safe place. If you suspect you or a friend have been drugged, call 911. that's not something I would ever do. But call 911, whatever, and tell the healthcare professionals that you suspect you and your friend have been drugged so they can administer the right tests. And remember that even if you were consuming alcohol when a sexual assault occurred, it is not your fault. You are not alone. And to speak with someone who is trained to help, call the National Sexual Assault Hotline at 800-656-HOPE, that's 4673, or chat online at online.rain.org. So, well, that's depressing. And now I'm like rethinking my college decisions.
Well, it's already over. You know, you did it. So you learned and you moved on. Can't do anything about it now.
Here I am. Nope.
Yeah, and you survived. So be happy.
Well, I'm alive. So now we're going to get into some serial killer and true crime news. And Beth, it sounds like you've got a juicy story, so I can't wait.
Well, it's an interesting one. An Australian woman discovered that her ex-boyfriend was stalking and tracking her through an app that was connected to her car. Yeah. She found out that her ex had been stalking her after she lost her phone, and she used her computer to try and locate the device. And she realized that her information was being sent to his email, including maps of where she worked and where she parked.
Get the fuck out.
Yeah, the man had helped her purchase a Land Rover, which gave him access to the car's VIN, the vehicle identification number. And this allowed him to set up an app that would track her movements and give him the ability to control her car from a remote location. The app was not identified, but the article suggested that it was probably the Land Rover's In Control app, which allows owners to start their car remotely, track its whereabouts, and control the temperature. It goes on to say that as technology has advanced over the years, cyberstalking has increased, with more abusers manipulating smart devices, such as security apps, to track their victims. Surveillance software programs, which are marketed as a way for employers to monitor their workers or parents to control their kids' online activities, is being used more as stalkerware. So beware out there.
Stalkerware. I guess we got to beware. Yeah, beware. Also, I have to say this. My impression of Australian men is that they are way more like sexually aggressive than American men. Yeah. Look, that was just my impression. And I think sexual harassment is rampant in Australian culture. Racism is too.
Yeah.
Anyway, I just had to say that.
Some of the craziest true crime stories I've read came out of Australia.
Serious?
Yeah.
Oh, boy. Yeah. Well, now we are going to move on to the shout out portion of our show. And I don't have anything. So, Beth, tell us what you want us to consider.
Well, I just have a real quick one. The podcast Slow Burn is on their season 3, which dives into the murders of Tupac Shakur and the notorious B.I.G. Did I say that wrong?
It's just funny. This was funny to hear a white lady say Tupac. It's Tupac.
Tupac. Okay. I actually don't know much about this because I am a white lady, but I found it fascinating. So yeah, there you go.
Isn't it though? I mean, the ins and the outs, and I mean, the industry, it really is a fascinating story. I haven't listened to the Slow Burn podcast, but every time there is a who killed Biggie, who killed Pac, a news story, I'm like, who did it?
Yeah, they haven't really gotten into that part yet. They're just talking about how they came up. And there was a lot in the last episode that I listened to about Ice-T that I didn't know.
Yeah, SVU Ice-T.
I mean, I don't know. How the hell did he get on Law & Order after writing a song about...
because John Singleton was like, I think that you would be really, really good on this show. I think. And he was like, all right, fine, I'll do it. And he's been
that's
on
nuts,
it for
man.
The past 17 years.
I know, that's nuts. 17.
Yeah, yeah. And to be honest with you, I don't think Ice-T was a very good rapper.
Right.
But he just took advantage of whatever opportunities came his way.
Yeah.
And also with the Notorious B.I.G. and Tupac, it's the East Coast versus West Coast, and hip hop people, you know, white people were like, ah, this is a fad. But little did they know, all their little white kids are like, oh, I love this hip hop stuff. And it hasn't gone away.
Yeah.
Because hip hop is powerful. So thank you for this recommendation, because now I am
going to listen to it.
Yeah. So where can the people find us, Beth?
Our website is fruitloopspod.com. Our Facebook page is Fruit Loops Pod. And our discussion group is Fruit Loops Pod Discussion on Facebook. We are also on Twitter and Instagram at Fruit Loops Pod. And links to our sources will be in our footnotes. If you want to support the show, you can send us a donation on the Cash App. Just Google Fruit Loops Pod Cash App, or you can become a monthly patron through our Podbean patron page. This will help us pay for things like our website and pod hosting. There's no minimum and no commitment. Even a dollar would help. We also have merch on our website now at fruitloopspod.com/merch.
That's all true. Beth is not a liar. This is a weekly podcast, and new episodes drop every Thursday. So until next time, look alive, guys. It's crazy out there.